Have you ever asked God to give you a sign? In a moment of indecision, you're standing at a crossroads and you don't know which way to go, and you just cry out sincerely, God, give me some clarity. Give me a sign. You've prayed like that? Yeah. Because Jesus has risen, that's something that we can do. We can pray like that. And not always, but sometimes, he answers that kind of prayer with something that's almost impossible to ignore. I was in my third year of my second degree at Princeton Seminary, and I was seriously wrestling with whether to continue or not. There was a group of young adults in Red Bank. Did any of you know that town? They had wanted to do outreach ministry with high school students, not in a church, but in the town where these kids hung out and caused mischief and skateboarded and did drugs. They believed that if Jesus were around, he would be with them in every way except for the drugs part. And they asked me if I would be willing to come and work with them. They believed someone who was theologically trained might help. Now that, for me, would have meant leaving the doctoral program. And so I was talking with people who knew me well, asking their opinions. Almost everybody said the same thing. Stay until you finish your degree. It will mean open doors. After that, you can decide what to do. There was one exception. It was a professor who asked me this question. She said, what do you think God is calling you to? And because I wasn't sure, I started praying and asking for a sign. I lived at that time on Alexander Street, right between the university and the seminary campus. I was walking one day to my office in Templeton Hall along the sidewalk that went through the campus. I paused at the one-way street that intersects the seminary's campus, and there I prayed in earnest, God, I don't know what to do. Please give me a sign. And that's not something I did frequently, but I prayed in earnest in that moment. I opened my eyes and saw that they had just recently repaved this one-way street. And as I looked up toward my office, they had also recently put up a brand new sign, bright red with white letters, wrong way. And I walked right past that sign to my office. Now, I'm not proud of it, but when I sat down in my office and began to do my writing work, I found myself thinking, God, I wish I knew what I should do. Could you give me another sign? Has anyone else ever experienced that kind of thing? Yeah. Disciples like me and like you will sometimes need reassurance from God, not just once or twice, but over and over and over again. There are times when God makes his path before us plain, when he gives us signs that he's real and he's with us, and quickly sometimes the confidence that those experiences build can go away just as quickly as they arose. The story that we're going to look at this morning, which is recorded in the 21st chapter of the Gospel of John, if you want to find your way there, now, it shows us disciples who are needing another sign. On Easter morning, when Mary Magdalene went to the tomb, she encountered the risen Jesus who told her to go and tell the disciples. I told that story last week. She went and told them. That evening, Jesus appeared to them, even though the doors of the house that they were in were locked. He appeared among them and spoke peace to them. Do some of you know that story? The very next week, he appeared again to them in the same room. The story we'll look at this morning happens after that, but they're not in Jerusalem anymore. Instead, the disciples have left the city, some of them, and gone back up north to the place where they were when they first met Jesus, by the Sea of Galilee, also called the Sea of Tiberias. Here, let's look at the story. It begins in John chapter 21. Verse 1. Here's how John records the details. After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. And he showed himself in this way. John's going to recount another experience of the disciples with Jesus after they've already experienced him twice. Now they are up at what John calls the Sea of Tiberias, which is the Sea of Galilee. the very same place where the disciples were when they first met Jesus before they were disciples of his. Do some of you know those stories from the New Testament? The first time he met them, you got to help me here. I can't tell if you're alive. Yes. Okay. John tells us who was there, verse 2. Gathered there together were Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples. Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." They said to him, "We will go with you." The disciples who are named here, their stories are told in the beginning of this gospel. We see them before they know Jesus, and then after they meet Jesus, and everything changes for them. Before they know Jesus, most of them are professional fishermen. After they meet Jesus, they famously become fishers of men, as Jesus invited them to be. Everything changed after that, and they went on a journey that led them away from what they used to do into a life of walking along with this teaching rabbi, which ended in Jerusalem, the place where they had seen him crucified and die. The place where twice they saw him after the resurrection with signs that were enough to inspire faith. But now we notice that they are back at the very same place that they were when they first met him, before they knew Jesus and began to follow him, and they're back doing the same thing they used to do before they decided to become disciples of his. Now we can't know for sure. It seems an awful lot to me like these guys have decided to retreat from their faith with Jesus now that he's gone and not with them like he used to be. They've gone back to what they used to do, demonstrating a principle which I wonder if you know, that ordinary time has a way of eroding faith. Anyone else experience that? That enthusiasm and confidence in Jesus diminishes as the days pass. God can show you something that's spectacular, inspiring faith in you, and then as quickly as that faith arises, it can go away. So quickly as it takes a doctoral student to get back to work, just that quickly. I'm not the only one who's experienced a diminishment in faith after something spectacular, am I?
No.
That's because genuine faith will not be sustained by the spectacular. And maybe you want the spectacular, but this story here is enough to teach us that that's not how it actually works. That the ordinary demands of life, they can sort of erase your confidence and put you back into a mindset of doubt and insecurity that will lead to a retreat from faith. And I know this from experience, but I know I'm not alone. If you read through the scriptures, you can see characters over and over again who experience this. You know the story of Elijah and the prophets of Baal, some of you know that? The most spectacular signs of God's faithfulness, and immediately after that, Elijah goes down into the desert and wishes he was dead. His faith evaporated that quickly. Or how about the story of Gideon? You know the story of Gideon? Asks for a sign, God gives it to him, and what does he do? I need another one. And he gets another one, and he's like, one more. Or the history of the people of Israel makes it plain enough too. That God does miraculous things for them, freeing them from Egypt, obviously exhibiting God's power right there in front of their own eyes, and then it's not long before they want to go back, and they think, well, maybe that wasn't real. That's just how it works with faith. Disciples should not be surprised that it takes more than signs to sustain faith. Young people who go away to camp and have a wonderful experience of Jesus' presence there at a distance, when they get back to the ordinary demands of life, they might find themselves wondering if what had happened was real. The same thing happens for adults. Can we admit it, adults? Yeah, some of you will have had inspiring moments right here in this sanctuary, and then by the time you're in the parking lot, faith has evaporated. And you're swearing at the person who got out in front of you. Not that a parking attendant has ever reported this kind of thing to me. This story at least teaches us that we should not be surprised if, even if faith was vivid and real, there's a time where we feel like giving up. But more important than that, it teaches us something about Jesus. And that's why you're here. You're not here to learn more about yourself. You know enough about yourself, and you're kind of sick of yourself, aren't you? But you want to learn and need to learn about Jesus. See, when disciples retreat from following Jesus and go back, Jesus follows them. That's what happens in this story. They decide to go fishing and watch the results. This is the second half of verse 3. They went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Does that sound familiar to anybody? So if you're a person who reads the New Testament, you will remember that the first time Peter and Andrew and the sons of Zebedee met Jesus, the very first time, was on the same body of water after a night of fishing when they didn't catch anything. Verse 4, just after daybreak, Jesus stood on the beach, but the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Children, you have no fish, have you?" Fishermen love when you ask them that. They answered him, "No." He said to them, "Cast the net to the right side of the boat, and you'll find some." Again, does this sound familiar? It should. It's in the Gospel of Luke, where this story is recorded in their first encounter, that they don't catch any fish, and then they don't know Jesus, and now they don't know Jesus. Do you see that? That's very important for disciples to keep in mind so that we have the right outlook on ourselves. There will be times that even though we've given ourselves to Jesus, we won't know it's him. And you should expect that there are going to be times in life where it feels 100% certain to you that having put your trust in Jesus was probably a bad idea since things ended up where they are. And even in moments like that, Jesus might be coming to you on the shore. He might be calling out to you and you don't know it's him, like here. Do you see that? Oh, I hope that someone who's given up on faith is right now at least open to the possibility that maybe Jesus is right there like he was here. Often he comes to disciples and they don't recognize it like right here. But here he tells them what to do, and just like in the first time they did, they listened to him, and there's a specific outcome. The second half of verse 6, here it is. So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because there were so many fish. That disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on some clothes, for he was naked, and jumped into the sea. I think there are some details that John chooses to include that are just head scratchers. You can definitely read in commentaries. There are people who, you know, twist themselves in knots to make sense of this. No comment. Not every detail means something. Let's keep going. Verse 8. But the other disciples came in the boat dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, only about 100 yards off. When they had gone ashore, they saw a charcoal fire there with fish on it and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish that you have just caught." Now, here are some details that mean something important. Charcoal fire, that only shows up twice in the New Testament. Here and a little bit earlier in John's gospel, Peter, when he was asked if he knew Jesus, was warming himself by a charcoal fire when he said no 3 times. Do some of you know that story? John's careful to point out it was a charcoal fire then, and now on the beach it's another charcoal fire. Because there's going to be a reunion between Peter and Jesus where things are going to be set straight. We'll talk about that another week, but that detail matters. Same with the bread and the fish. John does not want his readers to have a misunderstanding about what the resurrection is and what it is not. Some people think of the resurrection as some kind of spiritual reality, like Jesus went on living in the minds and the hearts of the disciples. No, John has Jesus at a real fire with fish and bread because the resurrection was not just a spiritual thing, it was actually a physical thing. And whatever you believe about the possibility, you at least have to know what you're rejecting. If you reject it, the hope of Christians is that the body of Jesus was raised again, a physical body body. There are moments when the disciples think, seeing Jesus, that maybe it's a ghost. And Jesus says to them, look, ghosts don't have flesh and blood like I do. Feel my arms. I am a person. I have a real body. And that, friends, is the hope of the resurrection for us, that when Jesus returns, we will somehow miraculously be resurrected and be given new resurrected bodies, which are in some ways continuous with our old bodies. Remember, Jesus' body had the scars, but also in other ways discontinuous with our old bodies. We can pass through doors. Won't that be fun? And most importantly, our bodies will not be subject to decay or corruption, so that they will go on forever and they will be bodies that are awesome in every way a body can be awesome. 25. Someone's thinking, like, how old will the body be? I think 25. Or it could be a little older. Jesus was 33, so maybe that's the ideal body age. But whatever it is, that's what we're meant to hope for, and that's what's happening here. Jesus is called in the New Testament the firstborn among many. And that's the hope for us when he returns, that we'll be given new bodies that can eat fish and bread. So here they are on the shore, in the presence, if you don't like fish and bread, just replace it with your two favorite foods. They're in the presence of the risen Jesus. This miracle has happened, and they know it's him now, but they're not able to say anything. They're feeling uneasy, probably about their retreat. But they're in the presence of Jesus. Watch what happens. This is verse 11. So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. And though there were so many, the net was not torn. The net that carried all of those fish was intact, even though it had 153 fish in it. This is another detail that has real meaning. In fact, some say there is no detail in this story which is more important than this one right here. When I was in my office that afternoon, after receiving one sign that ought to have been good enough from God, and when I finished up my work and prayed for another sign, I left Templeton Hall and began to walk back toward Alexander Street. Across that one-way road again, passing the post office on the seminary campus on my left, and then before I crossed the street to get to Alexander, I looked to the left, and I could see Miller Chapel there, and there were students filing into the chapel. It was the end of the week, and at the end of the week, there was always a worship service that students were invited to attend, but not obliged to attend. And then when I saw all of the students go in, it had been a while since I'd been to worship, all at once I felt as if the voice of God was speaking in my heart. Christian, go to worship, you fool. You're going to ask me for a sign and then go back to your room? Go to worship. And so I did. I walked into the chapel thinking, okay, God, maybe you have something to say to me. I sat in the very back. And that day, the preacher was Dr. Gillespie. He was the president of the seminary at the time. He'd been a pastor for a long time, very wise man, a New Testament scholar. His text that day was the story that we're reading together right now. I had never heard a sermon on that text before that day. I listened with real attention as he unfolded this dynamic of the disciples turning away, but Jesus following them, and then appearing like he had when they first met him, and as he unfolded the details which meant something and which did not. When Dr. Gillespie got to this point in the story, he paused and said, this number of fish, 153, this is the key. This is the secret to the meaning of this story. This miracle is a miracle about mission, he said. Now, this is an aside, and I'll get back to what he said, but when he stood that day in front of that sanctuary filled with seminarians, what he saw were young men and women, students, who he had hoped were being prepared for mission out in the world. And what he was confident of was that the church was meant to be a place where all kinds of people would be invited to Jesus. And when he looked at the gathering, including me, he knew that each and every one of us had a part to play in the mission of the church. And I need you to know this, even those of you who have never seen before, I believe that you have a part to play in the mission of bringing people to Jesus. I actually believe that. I believe that every one of you was meant to come to him and know him in a way that would change your life completely. And subsequent to that, you would become a person who, like the disciples had originally, would bring other people into the presence of Jesus. Do you understand that I think that about you? Yeah, and if I'm wrong, okay, but I actually believe it about every one of you. Dr. Gillespie said, in my many years of ministry, I've heard all kinds of conjecture about the meaning of this number. That dude had a lot of years of ministry. He was 170 years old. No, he looked like that to me. But he'd been a pastor for a long time. He explained that many, many people want to find... Come on, that was funny, wasn't it? It's not mean. Dr. Gillespie would think that was funny. And he's not alive anymore anyway, so... Many people have, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Many people have tried to find the Trinity in this number, he explained to us. It's 153 is three fifties plus three, Trinity, Trinity. Or it's the number of the Jews, 100, plus the number of Gentiles, 50, and then the three left over stand for the Trinity. My favorite of all the explanations, if you take the number 17 and make 17 dots and then 16 dots above them and then 15, 14, 13, all the way up to 1, you end up with an equilateral triangle. And if you add up all those numbers, it comes to 153, a perfectly triangular number, Trinity. That's not what it means. Gillespie was emphatic. It's not about the Trinity. If you were to do a review of the ancient zoological Greek records, you'd come across a book that was common knowledge in the first century, which in Latin is called the Haliotics. It catalogs all of the known animal species on the world in the first century. The entry on fish, which was written by Oppianus Celix, lists every known species of fish at this time, and if you count them all up, the number you arrive at is 153. This is Jesus' way of saying that when the disciples listen to him and are willing to cast the net on the other side of the boat, they will succeed in bringing every kind of person to him, which is what Jesus wants. Not just some kind of people, every kind of person. After sharing this, Dr. Gillespie was really vulnerable. He looked at us and said, I have to admit that the seminary and our theological education's biggest failure is in preparing students who are creative. I think what we've done is produced students who are good at catching a certain number of species, but leave out a lot of species who will never come to church. And then he said, what's needed is a few students who are willing to be creative and take risks and go do things in a different way than has been done before so that they can reach the kind of people that will never come to church. That was a good enough sign for me. In the back, I thought about that mission to those young people in Red Bank, and it wasn't long before I resigned from the doctoral program and found myself living on Maple Street in Red Bank, going down to the park and hanging out with those fish. And man, I'll tell you, I had no idea how open they were to learning about Jesus and coming to him. And I just didn't know. I needed to be reminded of that. And this detail in this resurrection account this morning is meant to be a reminder to us as a church altogether and every one of you as an individual. So let's think for a few minutes here practically about what it might mean for us to take this sign to heart. First of all, for us as a church, and I take this responsibility as central to my work as the pastor here. What would it mean for us as a church to take this symbolic number seriously? For me, it would push us to have our sights as a church, not just on the kind of people that we would like to be here, but rather on every kind of person. Hoping that Jesus would use us to bring them to him. Maybe to bring them to church, but not necessarily, but definitely to bring them to him. And you know that those two things aren't the same. Do you know that? right? This church is not Jesus. There are many other ways to bring people to Jesus than to bring them to this church. And so what do I mean by every kind of person? I mean people who are spiritual but not religious. Have you met people like that? Or people who are religious but not spiritual? Or people who are neither religious nor spiritual? Every kind of person. Are you following me? I mean people who are really angry about organized religion. I mean people who couldn't care less about organized religion. I mean people who want to go off and start their own organized religion. I really do mean every kind of people, and that was the point in this miraculous catch of fish. I mean people who are close to us and we like and we're afraid of ruining the relationship with them by bringing up religion. I mean people who we don't like at all and can't stand. Every kind of person is meant to be someone who we are at work, in whatever way we can be, in bringing them to Jesus. Remember, Jesus wanted the kingdom to be like a net that was cast into the sea and caught fish of every kind. And even though it had caught every kind of fish, it was not broken. Friends, we are meant to be a church for the kind of people who are too good for Jesus and so bad that the greeters here might think they should turn them away. Every kind of person is the kind of person that we should be open to. And so practically speaking, this means that I and all of the staff and our elders and any one of you who's here who comes regularly enough to call this your church, you are also a part of this church. It means that all of us must take this sign as a challenge for ourselves together collectively to be creative and open to new ways, listening to Jesus, who always is coming to us with his word, and we should expect him to challenge us to new ways of bringing every kind of person to him. You know how easy it is for a church to get used to doing things one way and then to think that's the only way to do that. Do you know that? I promise you, I know it. Remember, Jesus said to them, throw the net out the other side. So here, I'm expressing this in front of you, I'm acknowledging this and asking you to have this mindset as well, that we would always be open to doing things in a new way if it meant being open. Here, our doors open and out in the world to every kind of person, because that's the mission that Jesus has given to us collectively as a church. What about you personally? Because the church is never just an institution. It's always comprised of real individuals. What might Jesus be saying to you specifically this morning? Maybe you're a person who said, yeah, I've been praying for a sign over and over again. Maybe this is the place where Jesus is going to give you a sign by moving your heart to be open to some new way of connecting with somebody who's not close to Jesus in order to bring them close to him. What might it mean for you? Let me start with the most obvious, because I can see signs of it even as I look. Maybe it's inviting someone to church who hasn't come to church before. I see someone who's here because someone invited him to church. It happens a lot in our student ministries, where students who come to the group have a friend who has nothing to do with church and then invites them to come along, and then they come along. It also happens in our children's ministry area, where kids who are as young as 4 or 5 years old, they go to school and make a friend, tell their friend that they go to church, you want to come with me. The kid doesn't know they're supposed to hate church yet. And so they say, yes. And then that kid comes to their parents and says, take me to church. And the parents are like, oh, I hate church. But then they come along and then they start to attend. And so we adults can do that too. Maybe there is someone that you know who you ought to invite to church. Again, this is not the only way to bring someone to Jesus, but it ought to be one way. And maybe you're thinking, oh, well, that person, but they would definitely say no. Please don't say no for them. I'm serious, it's not a good idea. You would be shocked how many people who have nothing to do with a religious community know that you do and are wondering why you've never invited them. And maybe they're thinking, well, it must be because I don't fit in or I'm too bad or whatever. Invite them, and if they say no, that's fine. But that's a first way that we can be active inviting people. Think of the most rotten stinker you can possibly imagine and get ready to send them an invite. Trust me, I can tell you from my experience, most people who are not spiritually involved are more open than you know. When my first year out in Red Bank, when I went out there, I was absolutely shocked at how many young people who had nothing to do with church, when I said to them, hey, some friends and I believe in Jesus and we're going to have a Bible study in the park on Thursdays. You can come if you want. How many of them said, oh, definitely. I'd never really heard much about him. It was stunning. That's not the only way to do it. So what are some other ways? Maybe just as important are the opportunities that you have, not within these walls, but outside of these walls, to carry yourself in a way that is different because of your faith, so that your friends or your coworkers or the people in your school look at you and they say something like, "Why are you always so positive when everyone else is so negative?" If no one has ever said that to you and you have faith, then you should pray that God will give you a sense of the joy of your salvation so you start to look happy. Can you do that? Right. And then when someone says that to you, and by the way, let me be sincere here just for a moment. I'll set what I was going to say, set it aside for a moment. Everything is okay, right? In the world right now, is almost everything seems messed up, right? But everything is okay because we don't know the solution, but we know the one who knows the solution, and he has us in his hands, and one day everything will be made right. So ease up and smile more, right? And then when someone says, "Wow, why are you so positive when everyone else is so negative?" Don't just say, "Oh, well, I'm just a happy person." Don't say that. Say, "Because I know deep in my heart that I'm right with God." And if they're like, "What?" Then say, "Because I have faith in Jesus and he's changed everything for me." And don't say it in a condemning way or a judgy way. You can't possibly say that sincerely and think you're better than that person, because nobody who knows Jesus thinks like that. So if you know that and you have a humble faith, which you ought to, then say it. And say, you know, hey, here's what you can say. Say, "I pray for the people that are in my life. The next time I pray, I'll thank God for the things that are happening in your life that you're grateful for. And I'll also ask for his help in the places you need help. How can I pray for you?" You see what I've done just there? That is throwing the net out the other side of the boat. And Jesus is coming to you spiritually right now with a sign. And the sign for you who are wondering, what does God want for me in my life? Maybe this is a sign. There's other ways to be creative. You know, there are quite a few people in this church who are in small groups. And there's a group, I heard about this about a month or two ago. There's a group in our church who decided one week when they met for Bible study not to meet in a home, but instead to meet in a diner. And so they had their Bibles with them and they sat down at the big diner table. And when the waitress came over and looked, they said, "Hey, we're a small group. We know each other from our church." And then they asked her, "Before we eat, we always say grace. Can we say a prayer for you?" And that was a way for them to show their faith in public. And she said, "Oh, of course." And then she told them what she wanted prayer for. When they finished the meal, they leaned in and they said, "Why don't we chip in and give her like a 50% tip today?" It's like buying faith. There are definitely worse ways to give extraordinary tips. Right? But this is just a glimmer of the kinds of ways that Jesus is really meaning for disciples of his, people who have been rescued and delivered, to receive his call to be fishers of men and women in creative ways and in different ways. Look, maybe there are some young adults in our church who will get dissatisfied with the ordinary path that the world is setting out before them, and they'll get their heads together and say, "Hey, you know what? Let's put our money together and buy one of those old Victorian homes in the center of downtown, wherever, and we'll live upstairs in different rooms, and we'll make the first floor a place where the kids who have no positive adult attention can hang out. We'll cook dinners, we'll get to know them, we'll teach them what we believe about Jesus, and let's see what he does. Maybe he'll bring some of them to faith." If that's what happened for me, if anyone here, by the way, decides to do that, reach out to me. I'll give you all the kinds of advice I can. The main thing I would tell you is, if Jesus is calling you to do it, no matter what anyone else says, even your parents, you should go for it. Sorry, parents. Of course, life will be such that faith will wear down. Of course, the inspiration you feel maybe in this moment will diminish. But genuine faith is not sustained by the spectacular. Do not trust your eyes too much, especially anytime your eyes are telling you, "Jesus, that was wrong. I shouldn't have put my faith in him." Listen, I'm not judging you for feeling like that. I know that the weight that you carry is beyond me to imagine. I know it. I'm 100% sure of that. I know my own grief and power, the power of failure in my own life, and how easy it is for me to believe that maybe it was a mistake to go down to Jerusalem, so I should probably go back to Galilee. I know it myself, so I'm sure it happens for you too. But I also know that I need to hear what I'm going to tell you, which is trust Jesus. He's trustworthy. And then the last thing, he's coming to you even now, every one of you. And he's coming with the grace of an invitation to a meal. And he's saying to you, remember what I want more than anything else is for every kind of person, not just some kinds, but every kind of person to be brought to me. Because he loves every kind of person. And we're the ones he means to use to do the fishing. So let's be willing to cast the nets out the other side. Amen? Let's pray. God, I'm so grateful for this time to be together with these people who are here. I trust and believe that each person who is gathered here today is here because you intended it to be so, and I thank you for that. I thank you for the ways that you've made yourself plain to us in the past, for the signs that you've given us in days behind us, which have made it plain to us that you are who you said you are. I thank you also that along the way, when there's doubt and uncertainty, that you manage to make yourself plain enough to keep us going. And I ask even now that you would use this time that we've spent together today to make yourself known, maybe to someone in here for the first time, but certainly to each of us in a new way. And then I pray that you'd be building faith in us as individuals and as a church so that we would be useful in bringing every kind of person to you, the shepherd of our souls. We pray for this in Jesus' name. Amen.